What do you think systematic oppression is?
Systematic oppression is because you don't believe that you have the equal opportunity for success.
You don't believe you.
On the evening of November 6th, a group of student activists intercepted Tim Wolf, then president of the University of Missouri System, on the street. He was on his way to a cultural event in downtown Kansas City, and he clearly was not prepared to define that term, systematic oppression. That's a problem for a university president in today's world. But would you be ready with an answer to that same question? I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're going to take a close look at some of the contentious terminology that's been flying around social media and elsewhere now that racial tensions have exploded on the MU campus. Later in the show, we'll explore the climate for intellectual debate on college campuses today. Are they safe spaces for all points of view? Should they be? We'll get to that. For now, a little vocab lesson, starting with systematic oppression. Randall Jelks will help us define this one. He joins us from the American Studies Department at the University of Kansas. Hi, Randall.
Hello. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm well.
First of all, oh, yeah?
Yeah, you want to talk about systematic oppression. Americans like to think in terms of individuality and individualness, but systems don't work like that. There are structures, laws, encoding. And when we talk about systematic oppression, which a university professor should be and a university president should always be familiar with, maybe not the common parlance of walking down the street, someone else, but a university president always should be. We're talking about those things that have excluded. We're not talking about whether I like you as an individual or you like me. We're talking about patterns, historical patterns, cultural patterns of exclusion encoded by law, economics, and other things.
Well, you know, I think it's fairly clear from the students' response, but what was wrong with Tim Wolf's definition of systematic oppression? Just to refresh everyone's memory, he said it's when you don't believe you have an equal opportunity for success.
Oh, what was wrong with that? It was very thoughtless by any measures. It put the onus on students who were asking a much more systematic question about the universities in a society that excludes. No one can deny historically that the United States, that the state of Missouri, no one can deny that the state of Missouri historically was a slave-owning station, that it was caught up in all the systems that it practiced, not a whole lot of things down the road. So a university president should be at least historically versed to enter in a discussion with students about that. What he did was typical of many of our politicians is to make this about individuals and individual behavior.
And individual beliefs.
That's individual behavior.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll stop there, not beliefs.
How does it work? How does a system with racism embedded into it affect me and my decisions, even my thoughts as an individual?
Well, I mean, you can take for granted on some things, not you as a woman, but you can take for granted some things that operate along the lines of from buying a house to other things that you might have benefits, not because you are somehow trying to be conspiratorial against others, but by the very fact that the historical systems have set up to protect your interests and not the interests of others. And that's what students are talking about.
When did this phrase, or even the underlying idea it describes, first really make a splash, I mean, in discussions about race?
Well, when we're discussing this, we're not discussing race. That's just a fictive idea. Race is something that we make up. We're discussing racism. And I think that the audience ought to be clear about that. Race is something arbitrary. You know, I mean, I'm dark brown. And so are many millions of people in the world dark brown. It's what we attribute to that dark brownness. That's important. And racism in the United States specifically evolves out of the two things, slavery and Indian removal. And I think that that has had long-term implications for the history and for the economics of our country.
Does this concept in your mind apply to other kinds of persistent inequities that don't, not racism, like gender-based discrimination, for example?
Of course, but so what if you're a woman and you're Black or Latina? Can you divide yourself? So these things play into it. All of these, what we try to get our students to understand is that race and class and other factors play into things that shape our lives. And again, I repeat, a university professor should be quite aware, or else he or she should not be a university professor or a president.
What is some of the current thought in your field when it comes to resisting systematic oppression? I mean, it seems like something with so much momentum and history behind it. How do people think we as individuals can resist it, even though it is not about us as individuals?
That's right. We're in a political debate. This is what we're in, a democracy. We're in a political debate and a political fight for how we do those things. What ways do we make public schooling fair? I mean, I'm in Kansas. The kid out in Western Kansas doesn't have adequate education. So we're in this political fight. Sometimes people want to make the political fight solely about race, but it is also about the deeper issues of class as well.
How long have you been teaching this concept?
How long have I been teaching this concept? Well, I've been teaching since I began my first job in 1992. So I've been teaching a long time. And I've taught at, this is my second institution teaching at.
Your students are, you know, the same age as the MU protesters, though obviously on a different campus with a different history. But do you see a difference in how this generation responds to the idea of systematic oppression, a shift in mentality?
I think students are quite aware of many things. First of all, I'm going to speak, if I can, for Black and Latino students. They've seen the first president of color the first Black president of the United States systematically disrespected from the floor of Congress by governors and by others. And so that's one awareness that they have that is different. Secondly, I think that these calls for austerity that our current politicians preach made students unable to afford university education and structures of opportunity.
So austerity is in like opposition to government services, tax-funded government services.
Well, all businesses have made their money off of tax-funded. You wouldn't be living in Missouri if the government had not claimed the land from the Indians. That's government. So I think I want to defeat that myth right now, that we all participate in government. This is just who gets to participate. Tax breaks for wealthy people just keep people wealthy and not all other people. So I'm just, my argument is very simple. Students have seen this, and the attitudes that have been demonstrated to the President of the United States have been also full game on college campuses all over the place. And so they are speaking back. You may not like how they're speaking back, but they're speaking back, and they have every right to speak back. Universities are democratic spaces. Likewise, people have the right to speak back. What I find interesting is when minority students speak back, then it is a claim to issues like free speech and so forth. When minority students speak back, it is you're hurting my feelings.
Yeah.
But someone like Jeb Bush could use a line like Anchor Baby, or Ronald Reagan could use Welfare Queen in those old days. And that was perfectly acceptable. But when people speak back to them, then it is, oh, my God, you're breaking the codes of free speech.
And we're going to get more into this in a minute. Randall Jelks, stay with me. I'm going to move on to the next term in our MU protest lexicon. That term is safe space. For that, let's talk with Charles Burt. He's a junior at UMKC, president of the LGBTQIA Affairs Council at the school, and he personally identifies as Black and queer. Charles, it's nice to have you here.
It's great to be here.
How do you define the term safe space?
Well, a safe space is an idea or a space where a person of a marginalized group can go to avoid the discrimination, microaggressions, or just general struggles of being a member of that community.
Can I jump in and ask you to define microaggressions as long as we're getting into some newish terminology here?
Sure. So a microaggression, I guess I could say it's like a backhanded compliment that somebody outside of a group calls a person of a group. So for example, You're very pretty for a Black girl is a microaggression, implying that if they weren't Black, they would not be considered pretty.
I see. So why is the concept of a safe space, why is it significant on college campuses today? Can you describe the dynamics that create that need?
Dynamics that create the need for safe spaces are microaggressions on campus. For example, like in classrooms, there are a bunch of different people coming from a bunch of different backgrounds and all participating in one discourse. So with that, you can have like offensive things being said, and people within a community, they deserve a space where they can go to avoid that. And those safe spaces can be exclusive, and they're not always inclusive of everyone. So in those safe spaces, they don't have to educate people to teach them like why something is wrong or why something is racist. They can just go there to essentially recover.
Yeah, just breathe.
Yeah.
Can you give an example of the kind of interaction that you were just describing, tense discourse in classrooms?
So a lot of times it comes from like just ignorance. A common one that I hear is that why don't Black people just like help themselves, or why don't they work hard to like improve themselves? And with that you have to discuss systematic oppression, where everybody doesn't get the same opportunities to increase or to enhance their lives or better their lives, quote unquote. If you're born into a poor community and you go to a underdeveloped school or like a low performing school, then you're still in that cycle of like systematic oppression, and you're not going to be able to pull yourself out of that.
So you have to do a lot of explaining this kind of thing. How do you feel in conversations like that, just emotionally?
A lot of times it's very frustrating because the person that I'll be debating with, they're more concerned with being offended rather than being educated. A lot of times there's more focused on being called a racist rather than understanding why you're being called a racist. So there's a constant defense against like, I shouldn't be called this. This is why I'm saying this, rather than like, you need to understand like, this is not okay to say, like, I'm telling you why this is wrong.
So there becomes confusion, it sounds like, around feelings versus ideas.
Right.
You know, I'm wondering, it sounds like you're describing safe spaces not as the entire campus, but as specifically designated spaces within the campus. Do you see the entire campus as a place that should be a safe space, or does that get kind of tricky?
It does get tricky because within safe spaces, it's important that you designate what kind of safe space it is. If it is an LGBT safe space, you have to make sure that you're speaking out against homophobia, transphobia. If it's a safe space specific to people of color, you have to speak out against racism and systematic oppression. When you just call it a safe space, people come into that space expecting something, but they don't. They could leave not getting that, which negates it as a safe space.
Are safe spaces kind of by definition exclusive, as in only a certain kind of person really belongs within it, or no?
Well, by definition, they can include people outside of that space, because you can go into that space to learn. But if it is an exclusive space just specific to that person of a group, that's perfectly fine because you're going there to recover. But if you're going there to include people outside of that identity, then you have to make sure that you're policing those people to make sure that they're learning and rather not just there to like harass or like to educate themselves, like at the expense of the people who are a part of that identity.
So does the policing aspect of it become kind of uncomfortable or hard to negotiate?
It can become uncomfortable, but that's something that you just have to deal with. You have to understand that when you go into this space, if you say something that is problematic, you're going to be called out for it. And that's perfectly fine. And that's perfectly something that you should be expecting because you're there to learn and there to better yourself.
How have you related to the MU protests as a UMKC student?
As a UMKC student, I can sympathize with the students at Mizzou. At Mizzou, it's a different problem in that the racism there is very blatant. It's very like out in the open rather than at UMKC. It's more anonymous and more hidden. At the same time, I can understand that their frustrations are completely valid and all of their efforts are completely justified.
Some people might view the safe space concept as being like when you play tag, you're on base. It's the place where no one can tag you. In this case, I take it to mean that no one can say injurious things or treat you as less than, and certainly no one should be, I mean, anywhere, but especially in a safe space, saying or doing anything to threaten your safety and well-being, which makes total sense. I guess the question that arises is how we learn to confront real tensions that exist in society when our approach is to protect ourselves and each other from those tensions. Is there some nuance here that you'd like to clarify?
I guess it's a matter of education. So in order to not offend, you should do your best to learn more or to learn more about that community. So when you go into safe spaces or when you interact with people of this community, that you're not offending. And then people of that community, we understand that you may not know everything and that we may have to like tell you like, hey, that's a problem. But when it gets to the point where it's very like intentional or very like oppressive, it's kind of clear that you're not educated and kind of clear that you don't care. So that's when it does get to the point where there's like there's tensions have risen rather than it's a more like a mutual educational experience.
Some of the video that got passed around from the MU protest shows students and an instructor invoking the concept of a safe space to keep journalists out of a protest encampment. Is that proper use of the term safe space? I mean, does it include a sense of protection from a media presence?
Definitely. So I think all of that effort to keep media out of that safe space was completely called for. Those journalists and reporters at that time, they felt that they had a right to those black bodies in that space, which is more which is an example of systematic oppression and just racism in general. They didn't deserve to have a story. And when students told them that they didn't belong in that space, it was their duty to leave rather than continue to persist and fight for a story. So when students tell them to leave, they should have just left rather than complain or have their feelings hurt.
This brings us to another term that isn't new, although it's being invoked in potentially confusing ways, the First Amendment. Attorney John Peters teaches journalism at the University of Kansas, where he specializes in First Amendment and media studies, and he's going to help us out with this final vocab term. Hi, John.
Hi there.
What does the First Amendment protect and why? Just the Cliff Notes version.
Oh, gosh. I teach a 16-week course in that. So I guess I'll just piggyback in the comments that were just made that I do think it's understandable why the activists and the protesters did not welcome the media with open arms at the University of Missouri. I think that there is, for good reasons, long-held distrust on the part of minority communities toward the institutional press. In particular, in the black community, for the Black community, the institutional press has not done a very good job of representing them. There was a study recently that analyzed news coverage of, it was 26 local television stations, and found that Black people were rarely portrayed unless they had committed a crime. So I'll just piggyback on that, that I do think that, at least from a philosophical perspective, I can completely understand why the media would not have been welcome there. But then pivoting to some First Amendment principles here, when you talk about freedom of speech and freedom of the press and freedom of association and of assembly, all of which together form what we collectively refer to as freedom of expression. If you look at, say, the history of institutions of higher learning, they have limited freedom of expression in all sorts of ways. In the 19th century, they often forbade the expression of views that were inconsistent with Christian religious doctrine. In the 20th century, they forbade the expression of views that were seen as unpatriotic during World War I or as communistic during the McCarthy era. So much of free speech is a line drawing exercise where we are trying to figure out how far can we go before we go too far in restricting speech. A couple of threshold principles to understand about the First Amendment. One is that you as an individual have First Amendment rights only against the government. We have heard the term First Amendment invoked a lot in the last week and a half since the protest activities got underway at the University of Missouri and at Yale. And I think in a lot of cases, when we refer to the First Amendment, what we really are referring to is the larger ethos of free speech. Because again, you have to have some kind of government action for the First Amendment to kick in.
Yeah, can you explain what you mean when you say that the First Amendment is, that free speech has to do with use against the government?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. There's in the film, the Big Lebowski, there's a scene where, you know, the two guys are at the bar and they're arguing about something. One makes a comment to it's the tender of the diner that they're in. And they get into a dispute and one says to the other, hey, man, you know, you're violating my First Amendment rights here. That is not the sort of thing that the First Amendment contemplates. It is really not a shield or a sword for an individual to use against another private individual. That the Bill of Rights, so the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, it requires what is called state action. There's a doctrine in constitutional law called the state action doctrine that says the only person who can violate your constitutional rights is the government. So if you look at the University of Missouri protest in particular, the protesters who were on the Carnahan Quad there, everybody there has a First Amendment right to gather in that space because that space is under constitutional principles considered a traditional public forum, which is a government-owned piece of property that is held open and has been time in memoriam for expressive activities. The protesters enjoy a right of access to that space along with others, including the press. And so if a government actor were to come into that space and try to clear it out or try to regulate expressive activities there, that would be a First Amendment problem. If, however, you are a protester and you go, and let's say that you're just an undergraduate student at the University of Missouri, you go to a reporter who shows up to take photos or to attempt to interview people, and you go up to that reporter and you say, hey, you have to leave. I would appreciate it if you would go. And that private individual attempts to regulate expressive activities in that space. That does not implicate the First Amendment because the state action requirement is not satisfied.
So let's back up because it's not just the First Amendment isn't just coming up in this journalist student protester dynamic. It's also coming up just in discussions about the protests in general, like people saying that the First Amendment protects students' rights to say and do things that a lot of other people on campus would and beyond would deem just blatantly racially offensive. Talk to me about that.
Sure, yeah. Going back probably 60-plus years, the First Amendment has protected all manner of odious, hateful, distasteful, offensive speech. And a university is in kind of an unenviable position when it has to address systematic examples of systematic oppression or systematic oppression itself, because a public college or university is bound by the requirements of the Constitution, including those imposed by the First Amendment. And so I'll set up here kind of two sides of the same coin. One is that universities are required by two civil rights statutes, Title VII and Title IX, to regulate on-campus harassment and unequal treatment based on sex, race, religion, and national origin. Universities are not supposed to suppress speech based on its content. But if they don't do something about speech that could inflict psychological damage on a member of a protected class, then they risk exposing themselves to liability under a federal investigation conducted by the U.S. Department of Education and/or the U.S. Department of Justice. Until recently, the Department of Education used a particular standard to decide when speech could be actionable as sexual harassment. And they used, it was a standard of whether the speech would be objectively offensive to a reasonable person. That meant that harassing speech had to go beyond mere expression of views, words, symbols, or thoughts that some person would find offensive. And generally, there had to be some pattern to it. An isolated incident likely would not rise to that level. In 2013, the Department of Justice and the Department of Education broadened the definition of sexual harassment to include verbal conduct of speech that is simply, quote, unwelcome. And so since then, universities, I think, out of fear of federal investigations, have been defining unwelcome speech as harassment, not just based on sex, but also based on race, religion, and so on. This puts a university in a very difficult position, because on the one hand, you have the obligation of complying with, you know, Title VII and Title IX that impose those requirements on you. But on the other hand, you've got the First Amendment, which for a public college or university can't regulate speech based on viewpoint. There are really two fundamental ways to regulate speech. And one is to do it in a content-neutral manner. The other is to do it in a content-based manner. An example of a content-based law would be one that says that we are going to take an entire topic of speech, and we are going to regulate it based on that topic. So if I were to say to you that you may not engage in any expression about President Obama, it's just completely foreclosed. Content-neutral would involve... it's a restriction on speech that is incidental. It's imposed for reasons other than the content. So it could be that in a residential area after 10 p.m., you can't use a sound amplifying machine on a sound truck. And the reason for the regulation is not to restrict the content of speech. It's just to control noise levels in a residential area. And within content-based, I'll add one last point, that under the First Amendment, a particularly odious form of speech restriction is a viewpoint restriction. So rather than saying that we're going to restrict speech based on a topic, it's going to be a viewpoint within a topic. So instead of saying you can't say anything about President Obama, I would tell you, you can only say nice things about President Obama.
Well, John Peters.
The First Amendment generally doesn't tolerate it.
Assistant Professor of Journalism at KU, hold that thought. We'll pick right back up on this discussion of how the First Amendment applies to what's been happening at MU in just a minute. Then we'll want to hear from you about whether the current climate on college campuses leaves room for honest discussions about difficult issues. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. We're back this morning on KCUR Central Standard. We've been defining systematic oppression and safe spaces in light of upheaval at MU. And now we're getting a lesson on the First Amendment. If you want to call in and tell us, we're curious about whether college campuses are places for intellectual debate, safe spaces for all points of view, and whether they should be. 816-235-2888. For now, John Peters from KU's Journalism Department, what do you think are the biggest misunderstandings in the way the First Amendment's being invoked right now?
I think one of them would be this state action dimension that I just mentioned to you, that, you know, among friends, family, a lot of other people, students, I think there's a common misconception that anytime you have a restriction on speech, that it implicates the First Amendment, and they ignore whether the government is involved. And we need to look for some kind of government involvement. So if you were to look at one as an umbrella over the other, I would say that, you know, the freedom of speech, freedom of expression is much larger than the First Amendment, that we can invoke those principles outside the context of a case that would directly implicate the First Amendment to talk about, you know, what does it mean to have freedom of thought? What does it mean? What is the scope of freedom of speech? Is it verbal acts? I mean, is it verbal speech? Is it symbolic conduct? Is it the wearing of a swastika in Skokie, Illinois back in the 1970s? So I think that is certainly one misconception. And another one is that the First Amendment in principle and in practice is intended to be indivisible, that your First Amendment rights are my First Amendment rights, and they are the rights of all of the people around us. And so if you use as an example, I would hedge that, of course, with institutional realities that in the so-called marketplace of ideas, which is a seminal free speech theory that attempts to explain why we care about free speech in a democracy, that does not mean that every speaker institutionally has the same access or the same volume in that marketplace, because a systematic oppression, for example, would ensure that an upper middle class, highly educated, wealthy, you know, white man would have greater access to the marketplace than a member of the black community would. Going back to the comment that I made about, you know, studies showing that when blacks tend to get the attention of the news media, it's not for good reasons.
I want to turn to Randall Jelks of KU's American Studies Department, because Randall, you know, in this interaction between a photojournalist for a national news outlet and students out protesting, you know, you've got the students telling the journalist he doesn't have the right to photograph them. He's responding by saying that the First Amendment protects their right to be there, but it protects his too. From your perspective, what's going on?
Well, from my perspective, it's always contentious in a democracy when the media shows up. If the media is on your side, you say, oh, yeah, wow, I really want this to be good. If you feel that the media is not on your side, you want to push them away. What I find interesting is that this has happened countless of times with groups in the United States. When it's a group of black students, then it becomes an issue of free. That's when I think it's racialized. I mean, these things happen all the time. Groups sometimes, and journalists push their way in or get pushed out, so forth. This is the rambunctiousness.
What do you think of what you're hearing there, John Peters?
I think that all sounds reasonable to me. I mean, it's in the press, we're often the skunks at the picnic when we arrive. It's a reality of the job. And Tim Tighe, who is the photojournalist at the University of Missouri, full disclosure, he is a former student of mine from when I was a doctoral student at the University of Missouri and teaching there for two of the 3 years I lived in Columbia. And one of the things that, you know, Tim did rightly point out is that as a matter of First Amendment law, the protesters and Tim and anybody else who wanted to be in that public space, which, again, is a traditional public forum, they all enjoyed the same right of access to be there. And, you know, as I pointed out in an article that I wrote about a week ago, I don't blame the students for wanting to keep the press out. I don't blame the students for not recognizing the four corners of, you know, traditional public forum doctrines as the U.S. Supreme Court has laid them out. The case of the administrator and the faculty member in the communications department, I would separate them out. I think that to the extent that they were trying to regulate, you know, the expressive activities in a public forum, I would think that they ought to know better, just as a point of doctrinal law.
I want to jump in and let Charles Burt have a chance to speak. He's a UMKC student, and I wonder what your perspective is on this as just a student. I mean, do you think that there is any kind of tension between speech or the First Amendment and the concept of a safe space on any level?
I think the First Amendment is used as a excuse just to say whatever you want, and we've talked about that today. And it's just, as soon as everyone's free to have their own opinion, but once your opinion is infringing on the rights or the comfort of someone else, then it's actually wrong.
It's wrong just on principle more than from a legal standpoint.
Right, and you should put forth an effort just to understand, like, why is this wrong? Why is this offensive to someone else? So that you can change your behavior.
Call 816.
May I just jump in here
yes,
real quickly?
Please.
I think I want to put myself in the classroom, because I'm always in the position of teaching students about what is acceptable. Students are entitled to say ignorant things. I said ignorant things as students, but also the other students are entitled to say, you know, I disagree with you. What you said is has lots of holes in it. So a classroom, in theory, should be a space where students discuss. What often happens in classrooms, let me say on the university campuses, that professors feel uncomfortable with contention. And students do have different points of view. They do have different experiences. That's where the learning could come in. And as a classroom teacher, you have to give room for that discussion to go on. And I think oftentimes the failure at Yale was that the administrators, rather than sitting down and having discussions about costuming, about why this might be offensive to one, or forms for students to discuss. The failure was on the administrator, sometimes on the teacher, and in the classroom, not being able or willing to facilitate discussions of what are difficult subjects.
Call 816.
I'm just going to quickly put
a question out there to our listeners. Call 816-235-2888 to tell us whether there's room to talk through difficult questions honestly on college campuses today. 816-235-2888. We'll just have a few minutes for those calls, but we hope to get them in. And what were you going to say, John?
Oh, yeah. I was just going to say that agreeing with Dr. Jelks that as professors, a lot of what we do is we don't teach students what to think. We teach them how to think. And, you know, it's an idea that, again, goes back to Socrates. You know, we help them develop critical thinking skills. We encourage them to question their unexamined beliefs, the, you know, wisdom received and otherwise, the people around them, and to confront intellectually people and ideas that they would find offensive, distasteful, disagreeable, odious, and everything in between. I understand where the calls for safe spaces come from. And you know, I think the people who mock the idea of safe spaces are most likely the same people who can take their own safety for granted. I don't mock them. I wouldn't. And as a professor, I think that, you know, about the intellectual space I want in my classroom, debate and dissent are encouraged, and students can come as they are, regardless of identities and affiliations.
KCUR Central Standard will be right back after this break. I'm Gina Kaufman, back in a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman. You're listening to Central Standard, and I'm joined by KU's Randall Jelks from the American Studies Department and John Peters, who teaches journalism, as well as UMKC student Charles Burt, who's with us from the school's LGBTQIA Affairs Council. We're talking about the climate for discussion and debate on college campuses today. And we've got some callers who want to weigh in on this. I'd like to speak first with Joe in Midtown. Hi, Joe.
Good morning. Very good program. I'm African American, and I'd like to say that I'm strongly for a debate, and I would be opposed to safe spaces on the campus, any place on the campus, hall or you know, out on the yard or whatever. But I think a safe place when someone can be offended or who don't want to be offended, you know, you got your dormitory room, you got your frat house, you got your frat room, and so I think that's a place to get away from those people who may not like, you know, your color or what your philosophy is or opinion is on many things.
So are you saying that your own personal private space is in maybe the the only safe space that you see as sort of valid?
Yeah, I think on a college campus, you know, there's so many opinions coming from people from all over the country. I grew up in the Boot Hill. I went to Lincoln University and during the 50s, and I know about racism at UM because so many students came over to Lincoln for social activities. However, I mean, we've got to have some strong people to take on the battle of what is wrong with our country, and we can't run to safe spaces. When I took professional classes, some on campuses and some off campuses, I mean, I knew what the people were talking about when they were praising such people or wanting to bring up the ideas of certain people. It was offensive to me, but at that time, I was wanting to get an education based upon some knowledge that they had. And so, you know, my safe space was back in my room.
Yeah.
But I'm saying that safe space should be maybe a frat room, frat house, or your own dormitory room where you know, people who are not invited by the media or anybody else can't come.
Let's get some response. I want to turn to Randall Jelks on this because, yeah, you've been dealing with systematic oppression, safe spaces, and dissent, these concepts, for a long time.
Well, I think that I slightly disagree with the caller in this sense. Some people use safe spaces to holler out their dorm window, using slurs at both women and minorities through their dorm windows. Those are the issues that many students face on campus, that they don't want to even walk past certain frat houses because of the language that will be they'll be subjected to. People can have, I think we all agree that people are entitled to their opinions. But the opinions do have a way, public expressions do have a way of shaping campus life. And that's what students are talking about. So if I should call out of my window in my own safe space, you a name, and, you know, then those are the kinds of social interactions. We used to call these things civility, and the lack of civility that is now inhabits campus reflects the lack of civility in the society in general.
Let's talk to Al on the plaza. Hi, Al.
Wow, that was really good, that civility part. But I was calling in about something else that Randall said earlier, which I think is really significant, is that, and I don't know if he framed it in this way, but democracy is designed to be contentious. It is, it's the way that we process our system is through a contentious process, and it has to be allowed to be contentious, even if it's somewhat distasteful. But I think that Randall just hit on a really super important point, which is we have to learn how to be civil again. And I think this idea of free speech could be better framed as open speech. We need to be open about our beliefs and our ideas so that we can identify the problems and also the good and the bad points. But it is a contentious process. Democracy is designed that way. Everyone wants their belief to be represented in Congress, but the reality is that belief has to be modified by a contentious process, which we call democracy.
And so they have to be voted into office before. You have to vote first.
And they have to fight for it, yes. And you have to fight in Congress. The process in the halls of Congress is a fight, ongoing. Yeah. So anyway, I like this is a great discussion because it is a contentious process, but we need to find that place of civility as well. I don't know how we're going to do that.
Thanks so much, Al. Comment. Thank you.
Sure. Bye.
And now let's hear from Chris. Chris is calling us from Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Chris.
Hi, guys. So I'll try to keep it short. I'm the only Caucasian working in a highly diverse environment, and I really enjoy it. the thing that I would encourage people to do is deliver their message in a civil tone so that their message doesn't get lost through the screaming and what appears to be hysteria, because it takes away from the legitimacy. And with regard to the issue of trying to control public space access, they really don't have a right to do that. But if they want to exercise their rights to be heard in a public forum, they need to vote. These people, I'm saying that's all these people who are trying to rise up against injustice, they're not voting. And you can tell that by the people who are in power now who are limiting access to programs with systematic discrimination. So I would encourage people to lower their tone a little bit, be concise, and get out and vote. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thanks. Well, I'd like to get some response to that one. Charles, as a student who feels passionate about a lot of the issues that are being hotly debated right now and protested, what do you think about this idea of that someone thinks maybe scaling down the level of emotion or that kind of thing is important?
Well, I think scaling down or by like being docile, like that's been done, and that in the past, like it has worked, but what's been shown to work is rising up and fighting back. Martin Luther King once said that a riot is the language of our people, or the language of change. That's what gets people's attention. That's what's showing that this is something important, and this is something that needs to be changed. Yes, voting does change things, and that's what these people and these or students are doing that as well. But it's clear that people are not paying attention to them if they're just sitting back and not or being like well-behaved Black folk. That's not what needs to be done right now. What they need is someone to be loud and someone to be very passionate about what needs to be changed.
Randall Jelks, I wonder what you think about this idea about where voting comes in. I mean, enfranchisement has also been a contentious and you know, messy process over the years.
Well, I live in Kansas, where voter suppression is an all-time high under the current Secretary of State in the government. So voting sometimes and gerrymandering of districts sometimes prevents other people from having a voice. I do think I'm absolutely with the caller. We all should get out and vote. We should organize our vote. But I do think that there are processes by people who are in power who suppress votes and so forth. One of the things I want to point out is that when the Tea Party began organizing in 08, they had all kinds of contentious stuff put out and all kinds of contentious materials put out. I do think there's a differentiation in the coverage here. When Black students are protesting, they are suddenly now infringing upon free speech. Where when I walked down the plaza and saw Tea Party people with people painting President Obama with a Hitler-like mustache on, I couldn't stop that. But nobody said, well, that's rude or that you're violating free speech. But when students speak out and they have a right to speak out, they are in a government-funded organization. Their parents pay taxes to then it is covered differently. That's all. That's my point to you.
Yeah, Randall,
voting is important. Yeah,
I wonder absolutely. If anything particularly excites you about the current moment in terms of how students and faculty are interacting around social justice issues and race issues in particular.
Well, these are beyond just simply race issues, and I think that's the point. That these are about economic decisions. They're about one of the reasons we don't have more diversity on campus is simple. State legislators have increasingly cut budgets of state universities over and over again in the name of austerity. They stopped giving student assistance, making students more dependent on loans. I think those are the issues that are also underneath these things too, that we are also fighting about very much so.
So there are issues underlying the issues, and we're just starting to scratch the surface.
That's absolutely correct.
Well, our time is up for this morning's discussion and vocab lesson coming out of the new lexicon inspired by MU. Randall Jelks from KU's American Studies Department, fascinating observations. Thank you.
Thank you.
And John Peters from KU's Journalism Department, thank you so much for clarifying the First Amendment.
Thank you very much.
John and Randall joined us from the studios of KPR in Lawrence. And last but certainly not least, UMKC student Charles Burt, I really appreciate your being here today.
Thank you.
Listen back to this discussion by going to kcur.org/centralstandard. We'll have it ready for you there later today. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. And you can talk to us anytime on Twitter. We're at KCURCST and I'm at Gina KCUR. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman signing off. Up to date is next. Don't miss it.